The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Basic Oncology, Markers and Genes is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
Let's talk a little bit about cancer statistics. Now, here's the good news. You are not going to get an exam question that says, how many cases of prostate cancer are going to occur in the coming year? The answer is, we don't know. But this gives you a general trend. And I think if in someone preparing for board examinations, it gives you a sense about some of the questions that you might be expected to encounter. For example, I don't think you're going to have to know a whole lot about some of the cancers that are perhaps a little bit less common. You'll need to know some things about it, and if you are an initial certifier, you'll need to know a bit more and a little bit more depth than you will if you are a recertifier. But I think if you walk in there with really good basic concepts and understandings about the diagnosis, epidemiology, risk factors, and treatment concepts, for those patients who have the top four or five malignancies, you're going to be in really good shape. You'll also notice this morning that we haven't necessarily covered all of that this morning, but throughout the board review course, we've been able to weave in treatment of the various malignancies. And so over the course of 4.5 days, we've pretty much touched on all of these things so that you have a good balanced review. You know, probably the best place to start is, what is cancer? Vince Lombardi started off by teaching his Packers, saying, gentlemen, this is a football. So I think we kind of need to do the same thing. What is cancer? Well, cancer is defined by four basic things: clonality, autonomy, anaplasia, and metastasis. So clonality, indicating that all of the cancer arises from a single cell. Multiple cumulative mutations have occurred as needed to develop that cancer over the course of time. Autonomy means that we've lost normal control of cell division. Anaplasia means that there's lack of normal differentiation. And finally, metastasis, which I think is the one that everybody initially thinks of when they think of cancer, the ability to spread to distant sites. Well, this is a process that goes on. This doesn't just happen in an instant. There is a process known as malignant transformation that occurs in cancers as they move forward. And I do want to extend my thanks to Lori Fitterling, who is our librarian back at KCU, who was able to secure this slide as well as the opportunity to use it here. So I did want to give Lori a pat on the back for allowing me to do that. But the slide, I think, demonstrates a very important concept in that there are multiple hits that must occur in order for normal cells to become abnormal. So the thing that's important here is the general concept of malignant transformation over time. Multiple genetic hits resulting in increasing genetic instability that are now phenotypically expressed in malignant transformation and ultimately cancer development and eventual metastases. We know that cancer development can occur under a certain set of oncogenes. Those are the types of cancer genes that we can deal with. We also know that cancers can be prevented by a certain group of caretaker genes known as anti-oncogenes that control genomic integrity. So let's talk a little bit about oncogenes first. Oncogenes are genetic material which, when altered, can cause formation of cancer. So we've got things known as proto-oncogenes. May get asked this on the examination. And a proto-oncogene is a presumably normal gene which may potentially be a target for carcinogenic agents. It is not causative of the cancer in and of itself. So it has potential but doesn't cause cancer on its own. An oncogene, on the other hand, is essentially an activated proto-oncogene. It now has the capability to form a new cancer. We know that oncogenes can work through several different methods. The top three that I think we really need to know about for board examination purposes are point mutations, DNA amplification, and chromosomal rearrangement. So a point mutation will result in gain or loss a functional activity. DNA amplification will lead to overexpression of the gene product. So you don't gain or lose any sort of function, you just produce more of what you were normally designed to produce. Chromosomal rearrangement is a translocation of genetic material that results in a new fusion gene. So the classic example here is the Philadelphia chromosome, where you have a fusion between chromosomes 9 and 22 that results in a fusion protein that has tyrosine kinase activities. Tyrosine kinases affect cell growth and division, and thus, that's where we get our functional change. There are a variety of oncogenes that are out there, and it seems like we're adding to the list all the time. Walking in with a general sense of having this in front of you, I don't think you necessarily need to memorize this slide, but I do think it's important to recognize that there are certain oncogenes that can be helpful, primarily because we've got targeted therapies that we can utilize against these. HER2 has been active in breast, ovarian, and gastric carcinomas, and we've got Herceptin. We've got a couple of other agents that are out there now to specifically target the product of that oncogene. We've got RAF mutations, which can occur in gastric, thyroid, kidney, and melanoma. We've got the RAS family of oncogenes, which are active in a wide variety of malignancies, including bladder cancer, lung and colorectal cancer, and leukemia. We've got the MYC family, lymphomas, carcinomas, neuroblastomas, and LMYC, active in small cell lung cancer, and BCL2, which can be active in the lymphomas. And again, specific therapies can be available for those patients who express these mutated genes. And so hopefully this information might be helpful. So if they give you a patient with a BRAF mutation, for example, think about melanoma, and we've got a couple of targeted therapies here, as you can see. If it's a MEK abnormality, we would think about utilizing trametinib in that patient who has metastatic melanoma. ALK mutations have been very, very commonly expressed in those patients who have non-small cell lung cancer, and we've got some effective targeted therapies that are available for that as well, as you can see here. BCR-ABL is a classic gene that we see, again, the Philadelphia chromosome, that's active in CML, and these are tyrosine kinase inhibitors, imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib, that can be effective in that particular situation. So again, tumor suppressor genes or anti-oncogenes are genes that can decrease the likelihood of developing a malignancy. We all learned in medical school about the retinoblastoma or RB gene that prevents the development of retinoblastoma. So if you have one retinoblastoma gene, remember you get a pair of each of these, one gene that's inactivated, it doesn't seem to affect it too much. But if you take the second one offline, the risk of developing retinoblastoma increases by an order of 15 to 20 fold. So when tumor suppressor genes go bad, what happens? What's the explanation for that? Well, there are two things to think about. One are point mutations, so this problem comes back. Here we've got truncated proteins or no functional product at all. You've got the gene, it's missing a little bit of DNA, and it's just flat out not working. Or you can have large deletions that can occur that lead to a loss of a functional product. This can also lead to loss of heterozygosity in tumor DNA as well. Now, the other challenge that we have is that there's sort of material that affects the expression of the genes known as epigenetic material, and there can be what's called gene silencing. So the DNA is fine, it looks like it should be working great, but because of that epigenetic information, it's getting shut off and it's not being allowed to function. Therefore, we lose our tumor suppressor effect and cancer can result on that basis. Well, let's dig maybe a little bit less granularly here, kind of move out just a little bit and talk a little bit about genetic factors that might affect our problem. We know that for some malignancies, the increase in risk could be as high as 25 to 30 fold. Most of these are going to be autosomal dominant, so you can take that to the exam with you. If you see these abnormalities, 80% of the time, they're going to be autosomal dominant. So if you have to hazard a guess, that's the one to go with. We've got preneoplastic syndromes, and there are four varieties. This is kind of this real dry part where you've got all these funny sounding names. The first one are the hamartomatous syndromes, which we all learned in residency were called phacomatoses. So this is stuff that just kind of grows and causes all sorts of interesting problems. Neurofibromatosis, von Hippel-Lindau's in that group, tuberous sclerosis, Cowden syndrome is in there as well. Poots Yeager's. Jack talked a little bit about that when he talked about colorectal cancer and multiple exostosis syndrome. These benign lesions that can occur, these lesions that develop, can undergo malignant transformation into sarcomas in certain cases. These patients are also at risk for the development of gliomas in the brain, optic nerve, meningiomas, acoustic neuromas, and pheochromocytomas. The second preneoplastic syndrome we have are the genodermatoses. Now here we can have a little fun with Greek. So geno, genetic, dermato, skin, osis, condition, genetic, skin, conditions. So you may not know what the disorder is here, but if you can parse together a little bit of the Greek that you know taken into this exam, you can probably figure these out. So think about xeroderma pigmentosum as being a classic example of that. Also albinism and Werner's syndrome, epidermodysplasia verrucoformis, and all of these others can fit in here very, very well. Now, in this particular case, these are autosomal recessive genetic disorders. They will conspicuously involve the skin, as you would imagine given that name. We've also got hereditary immune deficiency syndromes. These are not the acquired folks now. These are the hereditary folks that bring their bad DNA with them, unfortunately. These patients have disorders like ataxia telangiectasia, Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, late-onset immune deficiency, X-linked agammaglobulinemia. These patients have a significant increase of risk of neoplasia. The one to really know about are the lymphoproliferative malignancies, chronic leukemias, and indolent lymphomas. These people can certainly have problems with that. Well, we alluded already to the risk of DNA damage and causing cancer, and so you might imagine that with a preneoplastic syndrome as a chromosomal breakage disorder, you would be at risk for that. So things like Bloom syndrome and Fanconi syndrome, sometimes called Fanconi's anemia, this is not the ones that the nephrologist talked about. There's two Fanconis that are out there. This is the genetic Fanconis that puts you at risk for acute leukemia. So those patients can be affected with that as well. There's been some discussion about Li-Fraumeni syndrome, so not to spend too much time on it, although I would point out to you that with Li-Fraumeni, patients are at risk for multiple malignancies during their lifespan. So it's important to keep that in mind. Same thing could be said for the Lynch syndromes, and you heard Robert Hastie talk a little bit about that yesterday, talk about the abnormal genes and how things all work together. So don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but just to get it in front of you, some things to jog your memory, that these would be genetic risk factors as well. What about radiation? Well, the good news is that if you take out skin cancers, less than 3% of all the other cancers are going to result from radiation. The one that we typically think about here is radon gas from radon daughters. Now, the radon daughters emit alpha particles, and so this is something that patients inhale into their lungs, and the inside mucosa of the lung is exposed to radiation from these alpha particles. The risk, obviously, is DNA damage and eventual lung cancer. I put up this picture of the Conqueror. This was probably the worst movie that John Wayne ever made. Has anybody had a chance to see this? If you haven't seen this movie, don't. It's horrible. John Wayne is Genghis Khan. And Susan Hayward, those of you who may be a little bit older remember that Susan Hayward was a pinup model during World War II and Korea. And you can see, here's a guy who supposedly lived like 300 or 400 AD, and he's capturing this woman who's wearing a show dress off of Las Vegas runway. So, you know, you can kind of tell you're already in for trouble. Well, the thing that's remarkable about this is that this movie was filmed here in the Nevada desert, and people who were involved with this movie died in high numbers of radiation-induced malignancies. So a lot of these people subsequently developed brain tumors, they developed leukemias, bladder cancers, all sorts of these things. It was one of the highest mortality rates for any movie Hollywood ever made. So, a bad movie, and unfortunately, it seems to have affected several members of the cast and crew in the years following that movie. So, the concept is that radiation from the Nevada test range, where we used to test atomic weapons from the 40s all the way through the mid-60s, really indicates to us that our body is at risk. In fact, nearly all tissues are susceptible to cancer from radiation. Most sensitive are going to be the bone marrow, breast, and thyroid. for acute leukemia, the latent period is only 2 to 5 years. 5 to 10 years for the solid tumors. There's a higher incidence in those who have received radiation for neoplastic disease or for ankylosing spondylitis. There aren't very many of those people around because we used to use radiation for AS until probably about the 1950s, but there may still be a few patients out there, and so this still may show up on the board exam, so I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention it. Children don't get radiated for thymic enlargement anymore, but there may be a few of those patients around. Sometimes this has been known to show up on boards too. So again, I just kind of wanted to get it in front of you. As far as skin cancer is concerned, solar radiation is the primary risk factor. It occurs on parts of the body that are exposed to sunlight. We know that patients, again, who have genetic diseases that tend to predispose to those sorts of things are going to be at an increased risk of that as well. The carcinogenic effect is somewhere in the spectral range of 290 to 320 nanometers. That's where the damage occurs. We also know that the risk is cumulative over the course of time. There has also been 2 or 3 clinical trials over the course of the last, I'd say, 20 years or so that have linked the number of sunburns with the incidence of melanoma. The cutoff seems to be 3 or more if you look at the data carefully. So if they give you a case where a patient comes in and they've got new nevi that look a little bit concerning and they've got 10 prior sunburns, those are patients who you should be very concerned about the possibility of melanoma. Tobacco. You know, we've been talking about tobacco for years now. We know that the incidence of lung cancer is 10 to 20 times higher in smokers than non-smokers. It's also associated with cancer of the oral cavity, esophagus, kidney, bladder, pancreas. Essentially, if they ask you if smoking causes a given cancer, the answer is yes. That's the correct answer on the examination. So that you're going to probably have something that clear. Now, it's interesting to note that we've got all sorts of biochemical things that go on here, but the real key is tar building up in the lungs. Tar contains over 500 known carcinogens, and the development of cyclic nitrosamines that produce carcinogens with the capacity to act on the cells of the internal organs. This is 1/3 tobacco-related malignancies, 1/3 of all male cancer deaths, 10 to 20% of all female cancer deaths. And I just want to review here. Smoking causes cancer. Okay, just over here. Smoking, cancer. You are welcome to show the slide to your patients if you like. Certainly feel free. So if somebody says there's no association with smoking and cancer, we have radiographic evidence that there is a direct correlation. So as a result of the increased use of tobacco by women in the period since World War II, the incidence of lung cancer deaths has now surpassed that of breast cancer. Lung cancer is the leading cause of female cancer deaths in the United States every year. It's been that way for probably 20 or 25 years at this point. But there is good news out there. If we can tell our patients to stop smoking, if we can get rid of the smokes, the risk of cancer development really drops. Back when I was in school, you know, 30 plus years ago, we used to hear that it reduces it to that of someone who never smoked. Well, that's not entirely true, but we do know that we can get that risk substantially lower. Not quite to that of a never smoker, but I think close enough that it's a good conversation for us to have with our patients. That may or may not show up on the boards. I think it's just one of those things that's common knowledge. Okay. Everybody wants to know what the high-yield slide's going to be or what the money slide is going to be, and this is it for this presentation. You are going to be guaranteed to have at least one question on your board exam about occupational exposure to some product and the incidence of cancer or what that cancer would cause. So if there is one slide in this slide set that I would commend you to memorize, this is that one slide. I know it looks like a pain, but it's money. If you're taking a recertification, you're probably looking at a couple of questions right here. If you're an initial certifier, you've probably got 4 to 6 questions right here, because you know it's a pretty hefty examination that you're going to be taking. So this is really an important slide. So you're going to need to know that arsenic can cause lung, skin, and liver cancer. Asbestos, not just mesothelioma of the lung, that's the one we jump on, right? It also is a cofactor for the development of non-small cell lung cancer. Benzene, leukemia, benzidine, which is a derivative of benzene, bladder cancer, chromium compounds, lung cancer, mustard gas, if you've ever been exposed to mustard gas, and it's a pretty youthful audience, I don't imagine you have, but if you have patients who have lung cancer. But remember, if you have patients who were treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma with the older DaVita regimen, which was MOP chemotherapy, M is for nitrogen mustard. It is a derivative of mustard gas. It was used in World War I and World War II. So you may be taking care of patients who received MOP chemotherapy or MOP ABV back in the more recent era, who would be at risk for the development of lung cancer just because of their nitrogen mustard exposure. Polycyclic hydrocarbons, lung and skin cancer, vinyl chloride. Guarantee you this is going to be on the exam. I don't know why they love vinyl chloride and its association with angiosarcoma of the liver, but whoever's writing the board exam has a love affair with this. So this is one that I think you really need to walk in on your sleeve so that you're ready to play that card. You can say, thank you very much, I'm on to the next question. This is just one of those things that will really pay dividends for you if you'll just take a little bit of time and spend it on that slide. Medications can cause cancer. Certainly chemotherapy can. But some of the things that we used to do, things like estrogens. We know that in women who were taking DES way back when, their daughters are at risk for the development of vaginal and cervical cancer. Why is this thing still on there? We haven't done that in more than 50 years because it keeps showing up on a board exam. I wish it would go away. It won't, so I want to make sure that you have that in front of you. We also know that estrogens increase the incidence of endometrial cancer. Use a progestational agent. Try to use the lowest effective dose of estrogen possible to minimize the risk. There's also correlation between estrogen exposure and breast cancer development. That's really all I want to say about that because the data is not entirely clear as to what that risk is. There does appear to be some correlation, though, so I would be at least aware of that going in to take the examination. Chemotherapeutic agents, the big dogs on the block are going to be the alkylating agents. Unfortunately, the biggest set of tools we have in our armamentarium as oncologists are the alkylating agents. There's an increased risk of acute myelocytic leukemia, bladder cancer, probably other malignancies as well. BRAF kinase inhibitors. We've been using things like this for melanomas and also for renal cell carcinoma for a little while now. BRAF inhibitors can increase the incidence of keratoacanthomas as well as squamous carcinoma of the skin. How do we manage that? We cut off the skin lesion. We keep going with the medication. We don't stop the BRAF inhibitor. Androgens, there is a risk of prostate cancer in those patients. Immunosuppressives. If you have patients who have organ transplants and they're on immunosuppressives, they're going to be at risk for the development of malignancy. I will just about guarantee you one additional exam question. That exam question looks like this. Mr. Jones comes in, he's 55 years old, he's 3 years out from a renal allograft or end-stage renal disease. He's been taking whatever immunosuppressive, doesn't really seem to make too much of a difference in terms of its relationship to the question. He presents with acute confusion, new onset of seizures, no prior history of seizures before, imaging studies of the brain, CT or MRI, take your pick, demonstrate a reasonably large midbrain lesion without significant vasogenic edema. What is your diagnosis? The answer is primary central nervous system lymphoma from his immunosuppression. That's a very classic type of board question. So understanding the risk, understanding how it all fits together, I think that's going to give you some pretty high yield in that situation. Now, medications aren't all bad. We do use medications as cancer preventatives. So things like calcium, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents, aspirin, we've seen a reduction in risk for developing colorectal cancer. Celecoxib, as Catherine and Jack, and I think Dick Darrow mentioned this as well. Celebrex is FDA approved for treatment of familial adenomatous polyposis in patients who can't or won't have a colectomy. What about vitamin D supplementation? You know, we like it because it makes us feel good. head, and it tends to minimize the risk of osteoporosis and the fractures that result. Well, as it turns out, there is some data out there that shows that vitamin D levels that remain relatively normal, those patients tend to have a lower risk of developing breast, colon, and rectal carcinoma. And in those patients who are deficient, the risk of those rises just a little bit. Now, it's not a huge risk increase. It's not like 3 to 5 fold or something like that. It's probably 10 to 15% higher than in those patients who have normal 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels. So it's important to keep that in mind as a potential test question. They may ask you about that. We've been using tamoxifen for breast cancer prevention based on a couple of clinical trials in women who are at high risk. We also looked at raloxifene, which is somewhat similar. It's also a selective estrogen receptor modulator, or SERM as we call it. It is effective in decreasing a second primary breast cancer, but the problem is it doesn't prevent in situ carcinomas, which are thought of in many cases as precursor lesions to invasive cancer. So data on Evista in terms of lowering risk, I think, are probably not as strong. We know that there is a direct correlation between diet, intake of fat particularly, with cancer at several sites. There's been some theories out there, but nothing concrete. So, you know, they may ask you what the theories are, but I don't think they're going to get any more granular than that. It's going to be either increased adiposity, increased bile salt excretion, one of those things that we've been talking about for many years now that may come in there. And I've added it here just to have in front of you, but I don't know how heavily they're going to test on this. But, you know, feeling that as osteopathic internists, we have a focus on prevention, this may be a potential candidate for a test question or two. So I think it would be good to at least spend a minute or two in talking about it. Think about fat. Breast and colon is going to be the primary thing that we're trying to address there. High total caloric intake is going to be breast, endometrium, prostate, colon, gallbladder. Animal protein, red meats, you know, I sure enjoyed my steak last night, but still, breast, endometrium, and colon, you know, obviously for men, colon's going to be something to consider. What about alcohol, particularly in smokers? Dude, we're in Vegas. What are you doing? You're killing me here. Well, yeah, here it is. Mouth, pharynx, larynx, esophagus, and liver. Salt, cured, smoked, or charred foods. This hits us Midwesterners really hard, but esophagus and stomach would be the considerations here. Nitrate and nitrite additives, intestinal carcinoma. So anything between the stomach and the anus is going to be pretty much wrapped up in intestinal carcinoma. What about infections? Well, we know that HTLV-1, the kissing cousin of the HIV, HTLV-3 virus, is a retrovirus that's associated with T-cell lymphoma, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, also known as mycosis fungoides, and acute T-cell leukemia. Epstein-Barr virus, identified at Epstein-Barr in New York, is closely associated with African Burkitt's lymphoma as well as nasopharyngeal carcinoma. Hepatitis B virus. We spent a little time on this in GI, and so we've linked that to hepatocellular carcinoma, and so we've had a little time to spend with that. We've also spent a little time with the hepatitis C virus. We know about that. It accounts for about 1/3 of all cases of hepatocellular carcinoma per year. Herpes simplex virus, a statistical correlation between HSV-2 viral infection and the incidence of cervical cancer, so it's important to know about that one. Human papillomavirus, kind of a nasty critter. It's strongly correlated with cancers in multiple areas. Helicobacter pylori. You know, when I was in medical school, we thought it was anathema to think that any bug could live in the gut. And when we discovered Helicobacter pylori, it was kind of surprising. We got its correlation between infection and peptic ulcer disease, but it wasn't until several years later that epidemiologic studies demonstrated that there was also a link with gastric carcinomas and with low-grade lymphomas of the stomach. So it's important to link those in. Now, the interesting thing is they may give you a patient with an Helicobacter pylori associated mucosal lymphoma of the stomach. The proper treatment is you treat their H. pylori infection, which, as you all know, is typically a course of therapy with a 3-antibiotic regimen over a period of several days to a couple of weeks. That's been associated with regression of the lymphoma. Pretty cool. You don't need chemo. It's a chronic process, and you need to follow them serially with EGDs. As far as tumor markers are concerned, remember that there are no perfect tumor markers out there. None of them are sensitive or specific for the presence or absence of a given disease. They're only helpful in following patients on therapy or monitoring for recurrence and things like that. PSA, prostate cancer, probably would be the one potential exception to that statement, in that we do know that it's reasonable that combined with DRE, even though that suggestion is somewhat in discussion at this particular point, there does appear to be some helpful component to testing PSA for men for prostate cancer. But a large number of these, I think, are just going to be available for you to have, just to be aware of. And you can, again, utilize these for following up.